A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel's been spending real time in Connecticut and Massachusetts visiting his in-laws, and something about those states genuinely unsettles him. He's Irish-born, lives in Jerusalem, and his affection for America has always been about hard work, social mobility, and the sense that Americans know how to have fun. But the New England he keeps encountering feels dour, restrictive, and obsessed with understatement. He points to the alcohol laws, the open container restrictions, the signage regulations in places like Mansfield, and he says if it weren't for family, he'd visit once and never come back. What amazes him is that Connecticut and New York share a border, but feel like they're built from completely different material. So his real question is whether the United States is less of a unified union than it appears.
That last part is the one that matters. Daniel's not wrong about the feeling. He's just looking at the surface of something much older.
So today we're asking whether Daniel is doing these states a disservice, or whether he's seeing something real about how a 400-year-old theological system still shapes zoning laws, liquor licenses, and the emotional temperature of daily life.
And I'll say this up front. I grew up in Storrs, Connecticut. I know exactly the feeling he's describing. The first time I spent a week in New York City as a teenager, I felt like I'd crossed into a different country, not a different state. A different country.
That's the thing worth unpacking. Daniel's version of America, the hard work and mobility and fun, is real. But it's a specific regional DNA. The frontier, the immigrant cities, the places built around commerce and reinvention, that never took root in New England's rocky soil.
Because New England wasn't built as a commercial project. It was built as a theological one. The Puritans who landed in Massachusetts in 1630 with the Winthrop fleet weren't fleeing to make money. They were building what they called a city on a hill, a holy commonwealth, a place where the entire community lived under covenant with God.
And Connecticut was even more explicit about it. The fundamental orders of 1639 are often called the first written constitution in the Western tradition. But that constitution was a covenant document. It was about binding the community to a shared moral order, not protecting individual liberty.
That's the key distinction Daniel's missing. Calvinism isn't just a historical footnote. It's a worldview that treats visible success and moral probity as evidence of election. You can't earn your way into salvation, that's the double predestination part. But if you're one of the elect, it shows. In how you work, how you behave, how you carry yourself.
Which produces both things Daniel notices. The work ethic he admires and the dour restraint he finds off-putting. They're two sides of the same coin. The same system that says work hard and build things also says loud joy and public display are suspect.
Right, because if you're focused on this world's pleasures, you're not focused on the next. That's not a mood, that's a theology.
So let's get into the actual mechanisms, because Daniel's talking about specific laws and restrictions, and those are the living fossils of this system. Connecticut's blue laws are the oldest in the country. The formal code dates to 1780, but the spirit goes straight back to 17th century Puritan Sabbatarianism.
The idea that Sunday is for worship, not commerce. And that produced this modern patchwork where you can't buy a car on Sunday in Connecticut. You can't buy alcohol before certain hours. The whole state feels closed in a way that other states don't. Daniel's picking up on that. It's not his imagination.
The alcohol regime, specifically, is a masterpiece of accumulated suspicion. Connecticut banned happy hours in 1981. That ban lasted 40 years, repealed only in 2021. And the whole time, bars were required to derive a significant portion of their revenue from food.
That food requirement is the tell. It's saying drinking as an end in itself is a moral hazard. Drinking with a meal is tolerable. Drinking for pleasure alone, that's the problem. That's not a public health regulation, that's a worldview.
Open container laws. The restrictive operating areas for licensed premises. The whole apparatus. None of it's arbitrary. It's the institutional residue of a culture that treats alcohol as a danger to the soul, not a social pleasure.
And then there's the signage. Mansfield, Connecticut has famously strict regulations. Small signs, muted colors, strict size limits. You can't put up a big flashy sign that says, "Buy here." That's not about traffic safety. That's aesthetic Calvinism.
The belief that self-promotion is a form of vanity. That the community's visual environment should reflect a kind of spiritual modesty. A big sign is a form of public display, and public display is suspect.
This is what Daniel's feeling when he says the place is dour. It's not that people in Connecticut are unhappy, it's that the culture is deeply uncomfortable with overt joy, loudness, display. Those things suggest a focus on this world rather than the next.
But here's the nuance that saves Daniel from being completely right. This same DNA produced the abolition movement, public education, and the innovation economy. The Puritan impulse to build a city on a hill cuts both ways.
Connecticut was a stronghold of abolitionism. The first public schools in America were in New England. The work ethic that built Yale and the insurance industry and eventually the aerospace and tech sectors, that's all the same Calvinist engine. The restraint Daniel finds off-putting is the same force that made Connecticut the Constitution state.
So the question isn't whether Connecticut is dour. It's whether the dullness is a bug or a feature.
It's a feature. That's the thing. It's the civic seriousness. The sense that the community has a responsibility to maintain moral order. That's not a lack of joy. It's a different theory of what joy is.
In the Puritan tradition, joy is private, earned, expressed through competence and reliability, not through public display. The sturdiness Daniel's father-in-law mentions isn't a euphemism. It's the actual value system.
And that's where Daniel's doing a slight disservice. He's reading the restraint as absence. But for the people who live there, the restraint is the point. It's what makes the place feel stable and trustworthy.
But let's get to the part that amazes him. Connecticut and New York share a border. How can they be so different?
Because New York was never a Puritan project. New York was founded as New Amsterdam in 1624, a Dutch commercial enterprise. The Dutch West India Company wasn't building a holy commonwealth, it was building a trading post.
And religious tolerance in New Amsterdam wasn't a virtue, it was a business strategy. You can't run a port city if you're persecuting half your merchants. The Dutch Reformed Church never had the political power the Puritans had in Connecticut.
So you get two different civilizational projects. The Puritans building a covenant community in New England, the Dutch building a market in New York, and those origins didn't get erased. They got preserved.
The proximity paradox. They share a border, but they're separated by a theological fault line that predates the United States by a century and a half.
The Puritan migration of the 1630s and the Dutch settlement of the 1620s created two different theories of what a community is. One says the community exists to maintain moral order. The other says the community exists to facilitate exchange.
And you can see it in the modern contrast. New York is a 24-hour city. Connecticut rolls up the sidewalks early. New York treats pleasure and display and commerce as natural goods. Connecticut treats them as moral hazards to be regulated.
It's not that New Yorkers are more fun, it's that the institutional framework never told them fun was suspect. The Dutch didn't care if you drank or put up a big sign or worked on Sunday, as long as the port was making money.
So Daniel's question about whether the U.S. is less unified than it appears, the answer is yes, but it's more specific than that. The U.S. is a federation of distinct regional civilizations, not a single culture with regional variations.
The Puritan Northeast, the Plantation South, the Frontier Midwest, the Extractive West, these are different civilizations that happen to share a constitution. The Civil War was the most dramatic expression of that, but the cultural fault lines never disappeared.
And here's the thing about the Constitution. It was designed to hold these different civilizations together, precisely because the founders knew they were different. The federal system wasn't an accident. It was a compromise between incompatible regional cultures.
Daniel's seeing that compromise from the outside. He's Irish, he's Israeli, he comes to America expecting one thing and finds five things. And the thing he likes about America, the hard work and mobility and fun, that's real. But it's a specific regional DNA that never took root in New England.
What's interesting is that the same restraint that produces Yale and MIT also produces the sense that everything is a little too controlled. The same civic seriousness that built the best public schools in the country also makes the place feel a little suffocating if you're not used to it.
And that's the knock-on effect. Connecticut and Massachusetts lead in education, healthcare, civic infrastructure. But they struggle with the kind of spontaneous creativity and risk-taking that flourishes in New York or California.
The spontaneous creativity is interesting. New York's creative energy comes from the collision of different cultures, different values, different ways of being. Connecticut's creativity is more institutional. It comes from the university, the lab, the established firm.
Both are real, but they feel different, and Daniel's picking up on that difference and reading it as absence.
So let me ask you, Herman, you grew up in stores. What did it feel like from the inside?
It felt normal. That's the thing about growing up inside a culture. You don't notice the water. But I remember the first time I went to a diner in New York at 2 a.m. and ordered a beer with breakfast. And I thought, oh, this is different. This is a place where nobody's watching.
Nobody's watching. That's the phrase. The Puritan legacy is a sense of being watched, not by the state, but by the community, by the moral order.
And some people find that comforting. The sense that there are standards, that someone's paying attention, that the community has a shared understanding of what's acceptable. Daniel finds it oppressive, and I understand why.
The open container law is a perfect example. In New York, you can't walk down the street with a beer either, technically. But the enforcement culture is different. The social attitude is different. In Connecticut, the law is the point. In New York, the law is a suggestion that everyone ignores.
That's the difference between a culture built on covenant and a culture built on commerce. The covenant culture takes rules seriously because rules are the expression of the moral order. The commercial culture treats rules as transaction costs to be minimized.
So, where does this leave the question of whether Daniel's doing a disservice? I think the honest answer is he's seeing something real, but he's missing the internal logic.
The doorness isn't a lack of joy. It's a different theory of what joy is. In the Puritan tradition, joy is private, earned, expressed through competence and reliability. A well-built stone wall, a well-run town meeting, a well-maintained house.
The joy of a thing done properly. That's the New England aesthetic. Not the joy of display, but the joy of craft.
And that's why the signage laws make sense from the inside. A big flashy sign is a lie. It's claiming more than the thing deserves. A small, well-made sign is honest.
It's the same impulse that produced the Shaker furniture, the simple meeting houses, the plain style, the belief that ornament is a form of dishonesty.
So Daniel's discomfort is real, but it's also a category error. He's applying New York standards to a Connecticut situation. It's like complaining that a Quaker meeting doesn't have a good party atmosphere.
That's a fair point. But there's also something Daniel's seeing that's worth taking seriously. The restrictions aren't just aesthetic. They shape daily life in ways that can feel limiting.
The happy hour ban was a real thing. 40 years where you couldn't have a discounted drink at a bar after work. The food requirement meant bars had to operate like restaurants. The Sunday restrictions meant the whole state slowed down once a week.
And if you're coming from a culture where the pub is the center of social life, where Sunday is a day for family and sport and being out in the world, the Connecticut approach feels like a deliberate refusal of joy.
It's a deliberate refusal. That's the point. It's a refusal of a certain kind of joy, the public, communal, slightly chaotic joy that Daniel associates with being Irish and being American.
The joy of the pub, the joy of the street, the joy of the crowd. That's exactly what the Puritans were trying to suppress.
And they succeeded. For 400 years. That's the remarkable thing. The institutional framework they built is still shaping daily life in 2026.
So let's talk about the broader question. Is the U.S. less of a unified union than it seems?
The answer is yes, and it's always been true. The United States was never one culture. It was a federation of regional civilizations that agreed to share a federal government for mutual defense and economic advantage.
The Civil War was the moment when the incompatibility became violent. But the incompatibility was always there. The plantation South and the industrial North were never going to agree on the meaning of freedom.
And after the war, the frontier West and the immigrant cities added new layers. The U.S. became even more fragmented, not less.
What's interesting is that the fragmentation is actually a feature of the system. The federal structure allows different regions to maintain their own cultural DNA while still participating in a shared national project.
But it also means that the national project is always contested. There is no single American identity. There are multiple American identities that sometimes cooperate and sometimes clash.
Daniel's seeing that from the outside. He comes to Connecticut and finds a culture that doesn't match his idea of America. But that's because his idea of America was always partial. It was the frontier myth, the immigrant myth, the commercial myth. It was never the Puritan myth.
And the Puritan myth is just as American, more American in some ways. The city on a hill is the oldest American founding myth. It predates the Revolution by a century and a half.
So the U.S. isn't less unified than it seems. It was never unified in the way Daniel assumed. The unity was always a political arrangement, not a cultural reality.
And that political arrangement is under constant strain. The cultural fault lines are always there, always shifting, always threatening to become political crises.
But here's the thing. The strain is also productive. The tension between the Puritan restraint and the commercial freedom, between the covenant communities and the trading posts, that tension is what makes the country work.
It's the same tension Daniel's feeling. He's caught between two versions of America, and he prefers one, but the country needs both.
The restraint provides stability, education, civic infrastructure. The freedom provides innovation, creativity, economic dynamism. Neither works without the other.
So when Daniel says he'd write off Connecticut if it weren't for family, I get it. But he'd be missing something. He'd be missing the part of America that built the institutions that make the fun parts possible.
The fun parts run on infrastructure built by the dour parts. That's the irony.
Yale and MIT and the public schools and the hospitals. Those didn't come from the commercial culture, they came from the covenant culture, from the sense that the community has a responsibility to build things that last.
So let me push back on that a little. Is it fair to say the commercial culture doesn't build things that last? New York built the Erie Canal, the Brooklyn Bridge, the entire financial system.
Fair, but those are different kinds of things. The commercial culture builds infrastructure for commerce. The covenant culture builds infrastructure for the community. Schools, hospitals, libraries, town greens.
The town green. That's the perfect symbol. Every Connecticut town has one. A shared public space at the center of the community. That's not a commercial concept. That's a covenant concept.
And it's lovely. It's one of the things I miss about New England. The sense that the community has a shared space, a shared identity, a shared moral order.
But it's also the thing Daniel finds suffocating. The shared moral order is exactly what he's reacting against.
Because he's an outsider. The shared moral order feels like surveillance when you're not part of it. When you're part of it, it feels like belonging.
That's the key insight. Daniel's discomfort is the discomfort of the outsider looking at a tight-knit community. The same thing that makes Connecticut feel stable and trustworthy to its residents makes it feel closed and judgmental to visitors.
And that's not unique to Connecticut. Every tight-knit community has that quality. The difference is that Connecticut's tight-knit community is 400 years old and has the institutional power to enforce its norms through law.
The signage laws, the alcohol restrictions, the Sunday closures, these are the community's norms made into legal requirements. That's what makes them feel different from, say, a neighborhood's informal social pressure.
And that's the Puritan legacy, the belief that the community's moral order should be encoded in law, that the state should enforce the covenant.
New York never had that. The Dutch didn't care about moral order. They cared about trade. So New York's laws are about facilitating commerce, not enforcing virtue.
And that's why New York feels freer. It's freer. But it's also more chaotic, more atomized, less coherent as a community.
So Daniel's question about whether he's doing a disservice, the answer is yes and no. He's seeing something real about the difference between the two cultures. But he's misreading the Connecticut culture as a lack when it's actually a different kind of presence.
The presence of the community. The presence of the moral order. The presence of 400 years of accumulated civic seriousness.
And that presence is valuable. It built the institutions that make New England what it is. But it's also alienating to someone who values the looser, more commercial, more individualistic culture of New York.
The question is whether the U.S. can hold both, whether the Federation can keep the Covenant communities and the commercial cities in a single political arrangement.
It's done so for 250 years. The Civil War was the great test, but the arrangement has held.
And the arrangement is the point. The U.S. was never meant to be a single culture. It was meant to be a framework for multiple cultures to coexist.
Which brings us back to Daniel's amazement that Connecticut and New York can be so close, yet so different. The answer is that geography doesn't determine culture. History does. And these two places have completely different histories.
The Puritans landed in Massachusetts in 1630 and moved south into Connecticut. The Dutch settled New Amsterdam in 1624 and built a trading empire. Those two founding moments set the course for everything that followed.
And the course has been remarkably stable. 400 years later, the descendants of the Puritans are still building Covenant communities, and the descendants of the Dutch traders are still building markets.
Not literally descendants, obviously. The populations have changed enormously, but the institutional DNA persists. The legal frameworks, the cultural norms, the built environment.
The built environment is a huge part of it. New England towns are organized around the green and the meeting house. New York is organized around the port and the street grid.
The meeting house versus the port. That's the whole difference. One is built for worship and community. The other is built for trade and movement.
And the street grid is telling. New York's grid is a commercial tool. It makes it easy to move goods and people. New England's winding roads are organic, following the contours of the land and the boundaries of the original land grants.
The winding roads are charming but inefficient. The grid is efficient but charmless. That's the trade-off.
And Daniel's preference for the commercial culture is legitimate. But it's a preference, not a universal truth. The Covenant culture has its own virtues.
The virtue of stability. The virtue of community. The virtue of taking the long view.
The long view is interesting. The Puritans were building for eternity. The Dutch were building for the next trading season.
And you can see it in the architecture. The New England meeting house is built to last centuries. The Dutch trading post was built to be replaced when it became too small.
So when Daniel says Connecticut is lacking for things to do, he's not wrong. But the things Connecticut has are built to last. The libraries, the schools, the town greens, the stone walls.
The stone walls. Those are the perfect symbol. Miles and miles of stone walls, built by farmers clearing fields 300 years ago, still standing. That's the New England ethos. Build things that last.
And the stone walls are beautiful. But they're also a reminder of the harshness of the land. The rocky soil that made farming so difficult. The climate that made life so hard.
The harshness shaped the culture. The Puritans didn't choose New England because it was easy. They chose it because it was hard. They wanted to build a community that would test them.
The test never ended. The harshness is still there, in the culture's suspicion of ease and pleasure.
That's the Dornis Daniels feeling. The sense that ease is suspect, that pleasure is a distraction, that the good life is earned through effort and restraint.
It's a hard culture. Not hard in the sense of difficult, though it's that. Hard in the sense of unyielding, like the stone walls.
Some people thrive in that hardness. They find it bracing. They find the restraint clarifying.
Others find it suffocating. Daniel's in that camp. And that's fine. The country is big enough for both.
That's the point of the Federation. Different regions for different temperaments. If you want the Covenant culture, go to New England. If you want the commercial culture, go to New York.
The problem is when the regions stop understanding each other. When the Covenant culture sees the commercial culture as corrupt, and the commercial culture sees the Covenant culture as repressed.
That mutual incomprehension is the real threat to the Union. Not the differences themselves, but the inability to see the other side's virtues.
That's where Daniel's question becomes really interesting. Because he's not just asking about Connecticut, he's asking about whether the U.S. can hold together when its regions are so different.
The answer is that it's held together so far. But the strain is real, and the cultural fault lines are getting sharper, not softer.
People self-sort. They move to places that match their values. The Covenant types go to New England or the Upper Midwest. The Commercial types go to New York or the Sun Belt.
The sorting reinforces the differences. Each region becomes more itself over time.
The question for the future is whether the federal framework can continue to hold regions that are becoming more different, not less.
That's the open question. And it's not just about Connecticut and New York, it's about the whole country.
The U.S. was always a federation of civilizations. The question is whether that federation is a permanent arrangement or a temporary compromise.
The founders thought it was permanent, but they also thought the Civil War might happen. And it did.
Let me bring this back to Daniel's specific experience. He's in Connecticut, visiting in-laws, feeling the weight of the Puritan legacy, and he's wondering if he's being unfair.
He's being fair to his own experience. The weight is real. The restrictions are real. The doorness is real.
But he's missing the internal logic. The way the weight is also the foundation. The way the restrictions are also the order. The way the doorness is also the seriousness.
The seriousness is the thing. Connecticut takes things seriously. Education, government, community, the built environment. It doesn't take pleasure seriously, or at least not public pleasure.
That's a legitimate choice. It's not the only choice. It's not Daniel's choice, but it's a choice that's produced real goods.
The goods of stability, competence, institutional strength. The goods that make a place feel solid and trustworthy.
The goods that make a place feel like it'll still be there in 100 years.
That's the covenant promise. The promise that the community will endure, that the moral order will hold, that the things built today will still be standing for the grandchildren.
New York can't make that promise. New York is always becoming something else. That's its virtue and its vice.
Connecticut is always staying the same. That's its vice and its virtue.
Daniel's discomfort is the discomfort of someone who prefers becoming to staying. And that's a legitimate preference.
But it's not the only preference. And the country is built to hold both.
Which is the answer to his question. The U.S. is less unified than it appears, but that lack of unity is the design. The Federation was built to hold different civilizations in a single political framework.
The framework has held more or less for 250 years, through civil war, through massive immigration, through economic transformation.
The question is whether it can hold for another 250. And that's not a question we can answer, but it's the question Daniel's discomfort is really pointing toward.
The question of whether the covenant culture and the commercial culture can continue to share a country.
I think they can. But only if each side recognizes the other's virtues. If the covenant culture sees the commercial culture as a source of dynamism, and the commercial culture sees the covenant culture as a source of stability.
That mutual recognition is hard. It requires seeing past your own preferences to the value of the other approach.
Daniel's in a unique position to do that. He's an outsider, which means he can see both cultures clearly. But he's also connected through his in-laws, which means he has a stake in understanding.
The in-laws are the key. They're the bridge. They're the reason he keeps coming back to Connecticut despite the discomfort.
They're the reason he's asking the question instead of just writing the state off. He wants to understand.
That's the right instinct. The understanding is the point.
Here's where I land. Daniel's doing a partial disservice. He's seeing the restraint, but missing the seriousness. He's seeing the restrictions, but missing the order. He's seeing the doorness, but missing the stability.
But he's also seeing something real. The Puritan legacy is alienating to someone from a different cultural tradition, and the U.S. is less unified than it appears.
Both things are true. The disservice and the insight.
The insight is the more important one. Because it opens up the bigger question about what the U.S. actually is.
A federation of civilizations. A framework for holding different cultures together.
That framework is under strain, but it's also the most interesting thing about the country.
The tension between the covenant and the market. Between the meeting house and the port. Between the stone wall and the street grid.
That tension is America. Not the resolution of the tension, but the tension itself.
Daniel's discomfort is a way of feeling that tension, of being caught between two versions of the country and not quite fitting either.
Which is, honestly, a very American experience. The experience of not quite fitting.
The immigrant experience. The outsider experience. The experience of coming to a place and finding it strange and trying to make sense of it.
Daniel's been doing that his whole life. Ireland to Israel, Israel to America. He's always the outsider trying to understand.
That's why his question is so good. He's not asking from a place of judgment. He's asking from a place of genuine confusion.
The confusion of someone who likes America but doesn't understand why part of it feels so alien.
The answer is that America was never one thing. It was always many things. And the things don't always fit together.
But they share a framework. A constitution. A federal system. A national identity that's loose enough to hold the differences.
Loose enough to hold Connecticut and New York. Loose enough to hold the meeting house and the port.
That looseness is the achievement. The ability to hold incompatible cultures in a single political arrangement without forcing them to become the same.
It's a remarkable achievement. And it's easy to miss when you're inside it.
Daniel's seen it from the outside. And he's seen the cracks. But the cracks are part of the design.
The design was never to make everyone the same. The design was to make it possible for everyone to be different.
That design is still working, imperfectly, with strain, but working.
When Daniel asks if he's doing a disservice, I'd say this. He's doing a disservice if he writes off Connecticut without understanding what it's trying to be. But he's doing a service if he uses his discomfort to ask the bigger question about what America is.
He's asking that question. The question about whether the Union is real.
The Union is real. But it's a political union, not a cultural one. And the difference matters.
It matters because it means the union can hold even when the cultures don't agree. The framework doesn't require cultural unity. It requires political agreement on a limited set of principles.
The principles of the Constitution. Federalism, separation of powers, individual rights. Those are the things that hold the union together.
Those principles are under strain too, but they've held so far.
The answer to Daniel's question is yes, the U.S. is less unified than it appears. But that's not a bug. It's the design.
The design is worth defending. Not because it's perfect, but because it's the only way to hold this many different cultures in a single country.
The alternative is to force everyone into a single culture. And that's not America. That's something else.
Something much less interesting.
Let me ask you, Herman. If you could take Daniel on a tour of Connecticut to show him what he's missing, where would you start?
The town green and stores. The library. The old meeting house. The stone walls along the back roads. The fall foliage when the whole state turns gold and red.
The fall foliage is a good answer. It's the one time Connecticut allows itself to be spectacular.
It's spectacular every year. Not because anyone planned it, but because the place is built to last and the trees have been there for centuries.
The trees are a good metaphor. They're not flashy. They just endure.
Every fall they remind you that endurance has its own beauty.
That's the thing Daniel's missing. The beauty of endurance. The beauty of things that last.
But I understand why he misses it. It's not the kind of beauty that jumps out at you. It's the kind that reveals itself slowly.
Like the stone walls. You don't notice them at first. Then you realize they're everywhere, and they've been there for 300 years.
Someone built every one of them, by hand, clearing a field that would never be very productive.
That's the New England story. Building things that last in a place that doesn't make it easy.
The things that last are the point, the endurance.
That's a value Daniel can appreciate, I think. He's from Ireland, he's from Israel. Both places know something about endurance.
But Ireland and Israel have different kinds of endurance. The endurance of survival against external threats. New England's endurance is more internal. The endurance of maintaining a moral order against the temptations of ease.
That's a harder endurance, and a more invisible one.
That's why it's easy to miss. The achievement is in what didn't happen. The corruption that didn't take root. The chaos that didn't overwhelm. The order that held.
The order that held. That's the Connecticut story.
It's a story worth telling, even if it's not as exciting as the New York story.
Especially because it's not as exciting. The unexciting story is often the more important one.
The story of the meeting house and the town green and the stone wall. The story of the covenant that held.
That's the story Daniel's in-laws are part of. The story of people who stayed and built and maintained.
The story is still going. The covenant is still being kept.
Even in 2026, even with all the changes, the town greens are still there. The libraries are still open. The meeting houses are still standing.
The stone walls are still marking the boundaries of fields that haven't been farmed in a century.
The boundaries endure. That's the point.
The boundaries endure because they were built to endure. Not because they were easy to build, but because they were built with the intention of lasting.
That's the covenant mentality. Build with the intention of lasting.
That's what Daniel's feeling when he visits. The weight of things built to last. The weight of a community that intends to endure.
The weight can feel oppressive if you're not used to it, but it can also feel grounding.
It's grounding if you're part of it. Oppressive if you're not.
Daniel's not part of it. He's connected through marriage, but he's not from there. He's always going to be an outsider.
That's okay. The outsider perspective is valuable. It sees things the insiders miss.
Like the strangeness of the signage laws. The insiders don't notice them. They're just the way things are.
But the outsider sees them and thinks, what's this about? Why can't you put up a big sign?
The answer is 400 years of accumulated suspicion of display.
That's a real answer. And it's the kind of answer that only makes sense if you understand the history.
Which is what we've been trying to do. Understand the history so the present makes sense.
The history is that Connecticut was built by people who thought the community's moral order was more important than individual expression.
That belief is still encoded in the laws. The signage laws, the alcohol laws, the Sunday laws.
They're not arbitrary. They're the institutional expression of a worldview.
The worldview is coherent. It's not just dawnish for its own sake. It's a theory of what makes a good community.
The good community is orderly, restrained, serious. It builds things that last. It maintains standards. It doesn't chase after every new pleasure.
It's suspicious of anything that threatens the order. Big signs, loud parties, public drunkenness, open display.
Those things are threats to the moral order, so they're regulated.
The regulation works. Connecticut is orderly. It's restrained. It's serious.
It's also, by many measures, one of the best places to live in the country. Good schools, good hospitals, low crime, high civic.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore. A thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear host. Until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.